A few minutes later, Sloane and Margot sat in the kitchen nook.
Start from the beginning. How did you meet Guy Menendez?
I was 23 years old in 1995 and working at a diner in Mobile.
Alabama?
Yeah. I started seeing this guy come into the restaurant every morning. He always sat in my area. He was real nice and polite and always left big tips. I thought maybe he was going to ask me out or something, but he never did. Instead, he asked if I'd do him a favor.
What was the favor?
He told me he was a lawyer. Gave me a business card and everything. Said he worked for an adoption agency and there was a problem with one of the adoptions he was overseeing. He was having trouble cutting through red tape to get this one baby to a couple that wanted her. He told me he needed me to watch the baby for a couple of months until he could organize the adoption. Offered me $15,000 to do it, and another $10,000 if I'd pose as the baby's mother when the adoption went through. Back then, I mean, hell, even today, that was a lot of money, and I needed it real bad. So I told him I'd do it.
So you took care of me?
Yeah, for about 4 months till he could get the adoption finalized.
What happened after 4 months?
To make the adoption legit, he needed to take some pictures of me and show them to the couple who wanted to adopt the baby. So he snapped some pictures while I stood in front of a white background. A couple of weeks later, we met again and he showed me a driver's license and passport with my picture on it. But not my name. The name on the IDs was Wendy Downing. He told me that for my protection, I had to hide my real identity during the adoption process. Of course, this got me nervous and suspicious. Like maybe the whole thing wasn't as legit as I thought. But when he gave me the passport and driver's license with that fake lady's name on him, he also gave me another $5,000. He'd get me the rest after we were finished.
Sloane saw Margot Gray look up at the ceiling.
I knew I was doing something wrong, but I felt trapped. After I took the first half of the money, I felt, I don't know, obligated or something to go through with it. After I met the couple who wanted to adopt you, I told myself there were worse things in the world than helping a nice couple find a baby to love. I just sort of blocked out the thoughts about where Mr. Menendez had gotten you from. Blocked out the idea that you might have already belonged to loving parents.
When was this? When you first met the attorney?
July of 95. I remember the date because it was my birthday the first time we talked. It wasn't until November that we actually went through with the adoption. In September and October of that year, I met the couple who was going to adopt you. We met twice for lunch, and I asked them a bunch of questions that Mr. Menendez wrote out for me, sort of like I was interviewing them.
Sloane slowly cocked her head.
I was with you when you met that couple?
Yeah. I was supposed to be your mom, so of course you were with me.
Sloane swallowed hard. She urged herself to think clearly, like she was back in the cadaver lab in medical school following the route a cranial nerve took through the brain. She forced herself to focus and get past the flood of adrenaline that came with somehow stumbling over what was certainly the biggest break in the case in decades.
And you had no idea how Mr. Menendez originally gained custody of me?
No. Other than that he said he worked for an adoption agency.
So how did you figure it out? That I was baby Charlotte Margulis?
I didn't back then. I never put two and two together. I remember that family going missing. Their story was all over the tabloids, but the way the news media told it, the entire family disappeared. I never thought what I was doing for Mr. Menendez was related to the missing Margulis family. After it was over, I took the money and got far away from Mobile, tried to forget about the whole thing. But I couldn't. At first, it really bothered me, and I became depressed about what I'd done. Even thought about going to the cops. A couple years went by, and the guilt sort of faded. For a while, I even thought it was gone. But that type of guilt never goes away. It just sort of becomes part of you. Then the other day, I turned on my podcast lady, Ryder Hillier, and she broke this story about baby Charlotte from the 90s, who had just resurfaced after being missing for nearly 30 years. Then I heard the name of the woman who had put baby Charlotte up for adoption. Wendy Downing.
Margot shrugged.
That's when I put it all together and knew I needed to find you. I needed to tell you the truth about what I'd done.
This man, Guy Menendez, the attorney. Do you know any more about him?
A little. He's kept in touch over the years. Every couple of years I hear from him. even if I move to a different state, and I've done a lot of that, he somehow finds me.
Finds you how?
Sometimes it's just a phone call. Sometimes he shows up in person to ask how I'm doing. He's helped me out with money a few times.
Sloane noticed that her fingers and hands were cold, as if all her blood had redirected to her cerebral cortex as she tried to understand what was happening. Guy Menendez, she suddenly knew, was the missing piece of the puzzle she'd been looking for. And Margot Gray was the link to him.
When was the last time you spoke with him?
About a year ago. He gave me his cell number in case I ever needed anything.
Would you share his number with me?
Margot shrugged.
Sure, I guess.
She dug in her purse until she found her phone, then swiped the screen to pull up the number. She pushed the phone over to Sloane. Sloane glanced at the screen and saw that it was a 530 area code. The same area code as Aunt Nora. Guy Menendez was in Harrison County. Guy Menendez was probably in Cedar Creek.
Listen.
Sloane stood from the kitchen table with a brimming urgency to tell Eric what she'd learned from Margot Gray. Hell, she considered calling John Michaels at the FBI. She had a phone number belonging to Guy Menendez. Surely one of them could track the number and find the man.
We can't stay here much longer. I mean, you found me through a record search of my Vrbo reservation, so it won't be long before the press shows up. I'm not ready to talk with them yet.
Yeah, makes sense. Ryder Hillier said she was coming to Cedar Creek to investigate.
I have a friend who's a police officer. His name is Eric Stamos. He's the sheriff here in Cedar Creek. And I also know the FBI agent who's been investigating my case ever since I figured out that I was Charlotte Margolis. Would you be willing to talk to them?
I'm not sure about that. The FBI? Would I get in trouble? I mean, I'm probably in some kind of trouble for what I did, right?
I don't know.
Sloane knew immediately by Margot's expression that it was the wrong answer.
Look, let's forget about the FBI. We'll just talk to my friend. He's local.
The sheriff?
Yeah.
I guess I didn't really think this through. I just wanted to tell you what I did so I could, I don't know, get it off my chest. I never planned to tell the cops about none of it.
I understand. And I'm grateful you tracked me down, Margot. I'm so, so grateful. But the authorities are gonna want to talk with you. You're probably the biggest break this case has ever seen. Trust me, though, they're not after you. If you tell them everything you just told me, I'm sure they'll work with you.
Work with me how?
I don't know, Margot. I'm not a cop. But trust me, the police and the FBI will be interested in what you can tell them.
I don't want to go to prison.
You're not going to prison. There's probably a statute of limitations on what you did. At this point, you're useful to the FBI for the information you can provide. That's it.
The FBI scares me.
Me too. So let's start with my friend. He'll be able to help us figure out what to do next.
Margot slowly nodded.
Okay, I guess I'll talk to him.
Perfect. Where are you staying?
Nowhere. I just drove up from Reno.
Sloane thought quickly of the best way to keep Margot Gray calm and close.
Let's do this. Let's get you a hotel room in town.
A hotel? I gotta be back in Reno for my shift tomorrow night.
Fair enough. But you're available tonight, right?
I guess, yeah.
Perfect. I'll put you up in a hotel tonight. We can go there now, and I'll bring my friend over so you can talk with him. It'll be private.
Margot looked around and finally nodded.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that.
Sloane swiped through her phone and booked a room at the Cedar Creek Inn, then led the way through town with Margot following in her Mazda. They checked in at the front desk and accepted two key cards to room number 303. The elevator deposited them on the third floor, and Sloane swiped her key card to open the door.
Just stay put.
Sloane stood in the doorway as Margot carried her overnight bag into the room and sat on the bed.
I'll be back in about an hour.
Promise me your friend ain't gonna arrest me or nothing?
I promise.
Sloane didn't know if she was telling the truth or boldly lying to this woman. Her college years, which had been spent studying criminology, told her that there was no way for Margot Gray to come out of this ordeal unscathed. But in that moment, Sloane would have said anything to this woman, because Sloane knew that Margot Gray was a conduit to her past, through which all the answers about her birth parents' disappearance might be answered. Margot Gray continued to rock at the foot of the bed after Sloane Hastings was gone. She searched for feelings that should be coursing through her body right about now. She waited for the relief she thought she'd feel after finally getting her secret off her chest. She tried to sense the weight of a 30-year burden being lifted from her shoulders. She anticipated the joy of having finally done the right thing. She looked for the pride she should be feeling for having pieced together what had happened all those years ago, and the righteousness for tracking Sloane Hastings down to tell her the truth. She looked for the inner peace that should have been on the other side of 3 decades of lies. But none of those emotions were there with her. The only thing present in that hotel room was fear. She didn't know much about the law, but it was hard to imagine that she wouldn't be in some kind of trouble for what she had done all those years ago. Even if the cops believed her story, that she didn't know the baby had been kidnapped at the time she went through with the adoption, she had still fraudulently posed as the baby's mother. That alone was probably some sort of crime. She bit her thumbnail down to the cuticle until she tasted the iron bitterness of blood. A thought occurred to her to run, to get in her car and drive far away from Cedar Creek. But where would she go? And how far would she get? She'd told Sloane Hastings her real name, and it wouldn't be hard for police to find her no matter where she went. Plus, all the money she had in the world was in her pocket, and it might last a week. She stood from the bed and pulled her phone from her back pocket. Mr. Menendez's number was still displayed on the screen from when Margot had shared it with Sloane. A thought occurred to her, and it made sense. At some point in this process, she would need a lawyer. She looked at Mr. Menendez's number and pressed send.
Hello?
It's Margot. I need your help.
Sloane took the Lewis Bullet Bridge over Cedar Creek, followed the roundabout until she was heading north on Harmony, and tried not to speed as she merged onto Highway 67. She dialed Eric's number again and listened as the call went straight to voicemail. She kept trying with no luck and gave up when she exited the highway and entered the winding roads that twisted into the foothills. She'd already left 2 messages and sent several texts asking for a callback. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she felt the anxiety of a ticking clock that told her Margot Gray would not stay at the Cedar Creek Inn for long. After 30 minutes, she finally crossed the wooden bridge that jumped the gorge to Eric's cabin and turned down his long drive. Eric was packing his bag in the back of the 4Runner and turned when he heard Sloane's car crunching over the gravel driveway. Sloane lowered her window as she pulled next to him.
Something's come up. I need you to come back to town right away.
What's wrong?
I found Wendy Downing.
Margot paced the hotel room and continued to gnaw at her thumbnail. It was a bloody mess by the time she finally heard a knock at the door. She hurried across the room, checked the peephole, and saw Mr. Menendez standing in the hallway. He wore a suit like he had all the other times he'd shown up out of the blue, either at her apartment or at whatever restaurant where she was employed. It had taken him only 15 minutes to get to the Cedar Creek Inn, and Margot tried to figure out why he, too, was in Cedar Creek. She opened the door as he walked into the room, wheeling a large suitcase behind.
You alone?
Yeah. I didn't know who else to call. We're all over the news.
You did the right thing.
You've seen it, right? The baby Charlotte story?
I've seen it.
Wendy Downing? They know who I am, or at least they know the name I used.
Tell me how you got here.
Menendez tapped his index finger on the hotel room's armoire.
To this town and in this hotel room.
You're gonna be mad.
Just tell me, Margot.
The true crime podcast I follow had breaking news that baby Charlotte had resurfaced. I knew about the story from back in the 90s, so I was interested in the details. Then I heard that baby Charlotte was put up for adoption by a lady named Wendy Downing, and that the FBI was looking for her. That's me, Mr. Menendez. That's the name you had me use on the ID you made me.
Margot waited for a response.
Keep going.
Anyway, once I put 2 and 2 together, my conscience got the better of me. I asked a friend for help, and he figured out where Sloane Hastings was staying in Cedar Creek, so I drove up from Reno to talk with her.
You spoke with Sloane Hastings?
Yeah. She's the baby you and I put up for adoption, isn't she? I know she is. I ain't stupid. It's bothered me for 30 years what we done. You said she needed loving parents, and that's what I kept telling myself over the years. But you never told me you took her from loving parents. You never told me you kidnapped her.
Mr. Menendez looked across the room to the closed door. He held a finger to his lips to quiet Margot.
What did you tell her, Margot?
Sloane?
Yes. What did you tell her?
I told her everything. I mean, everything I know, anyway.
Margot saw Mr. Menendez close his eyes.
You shouldn't have done that, Margot.
Yeah, well, I'm starting to wish I hadn't. But I saw it on the news and had to get it off my chest.
Margot paused before she asked her next question.
Did you kidnap her, Mr. Menendez? 'Cause now I got problems. They're looking for Wendy Downing. Ain't gonna find her 'cause she don't exist, but they're gonna find me, and I need help. They're gonna think I kidnapped her, Mr. Menendez, and I need to know what to tell them. After this all occurred to me, all I could think to do was call you.
Where's Sloane Hastings now?
She went to get her friend. Said he was the sheriff. Stamos, I think she said his name was. She was gonna bring him here so I could tell him what I told her. Started thinking about it and decided I want a lawyer with me before I talk to any sheriff.
Menendez pulled the desk chair into the middle of the room and faced it toward the window.
Here's what we're going to do, Margot. Sit.
Margot stood from the edge of the bed and sat in the chair as Mr. Menendez paced back and forth in front of the window. He stopped to stare out the window. Margot figured he was looking down at the creek while he drummed his fingers on the windowsill and figured out their next move. Eventually, he reached into the breast pocket of his suit coat and walked across the room, deep in thought, Margot believed.
I think I know how to handle this.
Mr. Menendez walked past her.
How?
Margot suddenly felt strange sitting in a chair in the middle of the room. Mr. Menendez leaned down from behind her.
Do you feel better having gotten our secret off your chest?
I don't know, I guess.
Good. You'll be able to rest in peace.
His words barely registered before Margot felt a sharp jolt to her neck, as if a ring of fire had enclosed around her throat. She reached for her neck, digging her fingers into her skin as she attempted to grab the cord cinched around her neck. She tried to twist out of the chair, but the pressure from the garrote pulled her backward and firmly set her shoulders against the backrest. For 30 seconds, she clawed at her neck. After another 30, she thought to open her eyes. She stared at the sunlight pouring through the hotel window until her vision was taken over by a black, inky ring that encroached from the periphery, slowly constricting her world until everything disappeared. Cedar Creek, Nevada, Thursday, August 1st, 2024. Since Ryder had dropped her video to her social channels on Tuesday night, the rest of the media had taken notice. Speculation had spread that baby Charlotte had returned to Cedar Creek, and reporters, hoping to cash in on the story, descended in droves on the small mountain town, hoping to land an exclusive interview, or at least record the first sighting. Ryder noticed the uptick in media presence and was desperate to beat her colleagues to the story. She sat in her SUV, which was parked in the back corner of the Cedar Creek Inn. Her cameraman dozed in the passenger seat. She rolled her window down when the inn employee exited the back door and made her way across the parking lot.
She reserved a room earlier today. She was with another woman, older, maybe 50.
You got a room number?
Maybe.
Ryder handed over another $50 bill. It was the third one she'd given the woman. The employee took it and stuffed it in her pocket.
303. Here's a key card.
She dropped the card through the window, hurried back across the lot, and disappeared through the back door. Ryder slapped her cameraman awake.
Carrie, let's go.
What's wrong?
We've got a room number. Grab your camera.
Eric hurried to the passenger side and climbed into Sloane's car. The tires spit gravel as she backed down the driveway and brought Eric up to speed on the details of Margot Gray.
Margot Gray?
That's the woman's name. Wendy Downing was an alias.
But why is she confessing to you? Or to me, or whatever is happening?
Guilt. From what she told me, Margot Gray was just 23 years old when a man approached her at the diner she waitressed at with a deal she couldn't refuse. The man told her he was an attorney and needed her help with an adoption.
Guy Menendez?
Yes. He told her he needed to cut through red tape in order to get a little girl to a couple who wanted to adopt her. Margot said she needed the money and decided not to ask questions. When recent news broke that baby Charlotte had returned home and that police were looking for a woman named Wendy Downing, she finally figured it out.
Then what, this lady tracked you down?
Yeah. The podcast she listens to mentioned that I was in Cedar Creek reuniting with the Margulis family. She found me by hacking into the Vrbo database.
And she's at your rental now?
No, I put her up at the Cedar Creek Inn. I figured my rental's about to be overrun by reporters. I convinced her to stay put while I found you. She's very much on edge. It dawned on her that coming clean about her role in my abduction could likely get her in some trouble.
It will. Unless you can lead us to Menendez and help us figure out what happened to your birth parents. Then there's probably a deal for her.
I'm not sure she knows any more than she told me. Guy Menendez knew what he was doing. He chose Margot because she was an easy target. And it sounds like the guy's been keeping tabs on her for 30 years. She said every couple of years he either calls her or shows up to check on her. Gives her money and makes sure there's nothing she needs or is worried about.
She's been in contact with him recently?
Sounds like it. She gave me his cell number. I'm hoping it'll help us find this guy.
My office will be able to trace the number. Let me talk to her first.
Sloane came out of the foothills and into town. She passed the Lewis Bullitt Bridge and turned into the parking lot of the Cedar Creek Inn. When she did, her stomach dropped.
Shit.
What's wrong?
Her car's gone. She had an older model Mazda and we parked right here. It's gone.
She and Eric took the elevator to the third floor. Sloane looked up and down the long hallway as she approached room number 303. She opened the door and entered. The room was empty.
Margot?
Eric checked the bathroom.
Empty.
Sloane walked to the foot of the bed where the woman had been sitting when Sloane left her. Margot Gray was gone. Cedar Creek, Nevada, Sunday, July 2nd, 1995, 2 days prior. Sandy Stamos turned down the long drive and pulled to a stop in front of the cabin. He opened the back hatch of the Suburban and grabbed the long, padded bag that contained the rifle he'd taken from the Harrison County Sheriff's Department. He'd come up with his plan after visiting Tom Quinn in Lake Tahoe and had made the call on the way home. He opened the door to the cabin and checked the time, 4:05 p.m. Company was due to arrive at 5, and Sandy was going to make damn sure the man followed directions and came alone. He'd made a tactical decision by arranging the meeting at his cabin, and there were pros and cons to the choice. The cabin was isolated in the foothills, and there was no chance anyone would discover the two men meeting there. Also, the cabin was on his turf, and he knew the lay of the land. If things broke bad, he'd have the advantage. The con, of course, was that he might have invited the enemy into his home, thereby giving away the location of his family's cabin, a closely kept Stamos secret ever since his father had become sheriff of Harrison County decades earlier. He grabbed a Gatorade from the fridge and headed upstairs with the rifle slung over his shoulder. He opened the window in the main bedroom, stepped over the sill until his boot gripped the shingles of the roof, and then ducked through. He scaled the A-frame roof and made his way to the chimney. He took his position behind the red brick and surveyed the land. From his vantage point, he could see the entirety of the valley and the town of Cedar Creek off in the distance. He also had a bird's-eye view of the road that cut behind the cabin and ran adjacent to the gorge his property butted up against. From his perch on the cabin's roof, Sandy could also see the wooden bridge that jumped the gorge and arched over the creek below, the lone access point to his cabin. Sandy pulled the rifle from the soft carrying case and positioned it on a bipod atop the chimney. He checked the sight and adjusted the focus so that the reticle was aimed at the beginning of the bridge. Lifting a pair of binoculars that hung from his neck, he trained them on the bridge and waited. 30 minutes passed before the vehicle came into focus. The BMW slowly crossed the bridge and turned onto the frontage road. Sandy kept the binoculars focused on the bridge for another minute, waiting for trail vehicles. None came. He turned back to the chimney, twisting the rifle in the process as he placed his eye to the scope. He adjusted the reticle to focus on the long driveway that led from the frontage road. As the car slowed and then turned onto the drive, Sandy set the crosshairs on the driver's side windshield. When Preston Margulis climbed from the car, Sandy kept the man in the crosshairs.
You alone?
It caused Preston to look around for the source.
Answer the question.
Yeah, I'm alone.
Stay where you're at and don't move. Understand?
What's this about, Sheriff?
Sandy didn't answer. He left the rifle on top of the chimney and climbed down the side of the roof to where a shed stood next to the cabin. He jumped onto the roof of the shed and hurried over to the side where he'd set up a ladder earlier. He clambered down to the ground, pulled his Glock from its holster, and hurried to the side of the cabin. When he peeked around the corner, he saw Preston Margulis in the same spot on the driveway. With his Glock out in front of him, Sandy emerged. When Preston saw Sandy, he raised his hands.
What the hell, Sandy?
Open the trunk.
What?
Open it.
I'm alone, Sandy. Who the hell do you think I'm bringing with me?
Humor me.
Preston walked to the back of the BMW and pulled open the trunk. Sandy came around and pointed his Glock into the back of the empty space. He went to the passenger's side door next and pulled it open. Also empty.
Feel better?
Forgive me for trusting a Margulis as far as I can throw him.
Sandy holstered his gun.
Where the hell are we?
My family's hunting cabin.
Why did you have me come all the way out here?
Because someone's trying to frame your wife for Baker Jauncey's murder. And I need your help figuring out who it is.
Sandy assumed two things when he concocted his plan to enlist the help of Preston Margulis. The first was that Preston had nothing to do with the murder of Baker Jauncey and would do everything possible to protect Annabelle. The second was that, as an attorney at Margulis & Margulis, Preston had unprecedented access to files and information that could help Sandy figure out who Guy Menendez was.
Can I get you a beer?
Maybe a whiskey instead? It's not every day that I have a gun pointed at me.
Sandy motioned to the kitchen island and for Preston to take a seat. He poured two fingers of Jameson into a tumbler and grabbed a beer from the fridge. Sandy took a stool next to Preston and pushed the whiskey over to him.
Okay, Sheriff. Start from the beginning.
Someone at Margulis & Margulis killed Baker Jauncey.
What?
Marvin Mann, Baker's investigator, tracked me down a few days ago to tell me an interesting story. Baker had stumbled across evidence of financial fraud inside your law firm. Money laundering, embezzlement, misappropriation of funds, and more. Baker enlisted his trusted investigator to help him figure out who was involved and gave Marvin a stack of documents he took from the firm. The next day, Baker was dead, the victim of an apparent hit-and-run. Marvin Mann came to me with his suspicions that Baker's death was no accident. He handed over all the documents Baker had given him, and I asked my accountant to take a look at them. The bottom line is that some very shady things are going on at your law firm. Baker Jauncey caught wind of them and was killed because of it.
Who? Who's involved in this fraud?
That's why I asked you out here. I don't know who's involved. But I'm hoping if I share what I know, that you'll be able to figure it out since you have easy access to Margulis & Margulis files.
What did you learn?
Sandy walked over to a cabinet above the refrigerator and removed a few pages of the files Marvin Mann had given him. These were copies. The originals were still stashed in the Reno safe deposit box.
This is some of what Baker found at the firm. It's just a taste of what he gave Marvin Mann.
Preston skimmed the pages.
If this is just some of what Baker found, where's the rest of it?
tucked away somewhere safe for now. And that's all I'll say until I know if you're going to help me.
Take me through what your accountant found.
For 15 minutes, Sandy laid out the complicated puzzle of the fraud taking place inside Margulis and Margulis.
There's no names on any of these pages. They're all anonymous shell companies and numbered accounts.
There's only one name in any of the documents. Guy Menendez.
Who?
Guy Menendez.
There's no one by that name at Margulis and Margulis.
Well, I figured that much already.
Tell me what this has to do with my wife.
It was a setup, Preston. Someone killed Baker and then made it look like he was hit by Annabelle's car.
Why?
Your guess is as good as mine. But here's what I'm stuck on. Your family has influence just about everywhere in Harrison County and much of Nevada. The Harrison County Coroner's Office is under your family's authority, and the coroner's office literally stole Baker's body from Reno in the dead of night and did their own autopsy. The only way that happens is if someone decided to meddle in the case. And when meddling happens around these parts, it usually has Margulis fingerprints on it.
That obviously didn't come from me.
That's why you're sitting here, Counselor. I need you to help me figure out what's going on. The Reno Medical Examiner's Office came to a wholly different conclusion about how Baker Johnsey died than did the Harrison County coroner. According to the coroner, the official cause of death was head trauma sustained during the hit and run. Reno says Baker was hit by a baseball bat. So, best I can tell, someone didn't like the idea that Baker's death was going to be blamed on him being cracked by a baseball bat, and much preferred the official line stating that he died from being run over by Annabelle's car.
So just to be clear, my wife is no longer a suspect in Baker's death?
Not so long as I'm running the investigation.
What do you need from me?
I need you to figure out who's behind the fraud at Margulis and Margulis.
And you think the answer lies somewhere in the files inside my law firm?
I do.
Preston pushed the whiskey away and stood up.
Then I'll go look.
When?
Right now.
Preston waited until nightfall to go to the offices of Margulis and Margulis. Hours earlier, he'd watched the cleaning staff exit the building, pack up their vans, and pull from the parking lot after leaving the offices immaculate for Monday morning. He drank coffee to keep himself alert as he bided his time. When he was certain the building was empty, without even an eager junior associate remaining, he climbed from his car and entered through the rear door. It was close to midnight. His office was on the third floor, and he quickly sat behind the desk and fired up his computer. The firm was on the cutting edge of technology and had digitized all its files over the last 24 months. Margulis and Margulis had been using internal email for years, but had leaned fully into the new internet age that was upon them. Preston was one of the young attorneys encouraging the transition to digitized files and electronic records, and was the point man for implementing the firm's conversion into the technological era. Because of this, he was more than familiar with the inner workings of the firm's digital files, and even without being a partner, had easy access to everything. It took just 30 minutes of sniffing to find the name Guy Menendez buried in the files. Once he was onto the scent, he never lost it. He spent hours digging through the firm's files and diving deeply into the financial records. The tracks were covered well enough for the lazy snooper or casual observer to miss, but armed with the knowledge Sandy Stamos had provided, Preston knew what to look for and found it easily. So obvious was the fraud and theft that Preston wondered how it had gone unnoticed for so long. Unless, he wondered, someone at the top was part of it. He spent all night picking through the files and unraveling the web of corruption. At just past 4 a.m., with his desk cluttered by computer printouts that carefully detailed the financial fraud and the way it had been covered up, he hit pay dirt.
Son of a bitch!
Despite the obnoxious hour, he picked up his desk phone and punched Sandy's number into the keypad.
Anything?
Everything. I know who's skimming the money.
Cedar Creek, Nevada, Thursday, August 1st, 2024. After Sloan left the Cedar Creek Inn, she dropped Eric at the sheriff's office. Margot Gray couldn't have gotten far. Eric would put his deputies on the lookout for an older model Mazda and alert the Nevada Highway Patrol. If Margot was still in town, they'd find her. If she were on the road, they'd bring her in. Eric also planned to run the phone number Margot had provided that belonged to Guy Menendez. In the meantime, Sloan knew it wouldn't be long before the press found her rental house. She'd accepted Eric's offer to lay low at his cabin in the foothills. She needed to pack a few things first, so she headed back to her rental house with a heavy mix of disappointment and frustration. As she pulled into the driveway, the sun was setting, lighting the clouds above the Sierra Nevada mountains in an eerie glow of crimson that screamed to Sloan that the opportunity to unlock the secrets of her past was bleeding away. Inside, she grabbed a Diet Dr. Pepper and sat at the kitchen table. She found Special Agent John Michaels' card and called him. Over a 15-minute conversation, she told him about Margot Gray, a.k.a. Wendy Downing. She gave him Margot's description and the make and model of the car she was driving. She read off the phone number that was believed to belong to Guy Menendez and answered a slew of questions from Agent Michaels.
Stamos, is the sheriff out there in Harrison County?
Yes. He and I have been, well, not exactly working together, but in close contact since I've been out here.
Something I need to know about?
Sloan thought about Eric's father and the mysterious link between Baker Jauncey's death 30 years earlier and the disappearance of her and her birth parents. She wouldn't know where to start.
Maybe at some point. But let's concentrate on Margot Gray for now.
Give me the day. I'll be in touch in the morning. Anything else?
Yeah. How did my story leak?
I'm launching an internal investigation to figure that out. But right now, I'm gonna run with the leads you've given me.
Keep me posted.
Will do.
Sloan ended the call just as she heard a car door slam outside. She went to the living room window and peeked through the plantation shutters.
Shit!
A CBS Channel 4 news van was parked outside. The back doors were open and a man pulled equipment from the van. Before Sloan could look away, another news van pulled down the road and parked across the street. A reporter opened the door and hurried across the front lawn. Sloan snapped the shutters closed as the woman reached the front stoop.
Shit, shit!
Sloan Hastings? Monica Campbell with NBC News. We're hoping to speak with you about the alleged connection to baby Charlotte Margolis and her parents who are still missing.
Her phone buzzed in her hand and startled her. She looked at the screen and saw that Nora was calling.
Hello?
I just spoke with Tilly. News vans are parked outside her house and reporters are milling around.
Yeah, here too. I'm at my rental and two news vans just pulled up. Some lunatic is pounding on my front door as we speak.
I'm coming over.
To do what?
Rescue you. Stay put. I'll be there in a few minutes. And pack your stuff. You're not staying there.
The call ended and Sloan went back to the front window. A third van had pulled to the curb. As the reporter continued to pound on the front door, Sloan heard more knocking at the back door off the kitchen. She briefly considered opening the door and giving them the soundbite they were all so desperate for, and the video footage and first live images they wanted so badly. But Sloan knew it wouldn't end with a simple statement. They'd want answers that Sloan did not have. She ran upstairs and packed her suitcase, emptying the drawers she had filled just a few days before. She cleared out the bathroom and lugged her suitcase down the stairs, just as her phone buzzed with a text message from Nora. Sloan watched through the front window as Nora tore into the driveway and screeched to a stop at an odd angle, the front wheels on the grass. She opened the driver's side door and stormed past the reporters who thrust microphones in her face and shouted questions as cameras rolled and recorded everything. Nora kept them at bay with an opened palm and a shake of her head until she was on the front porch, when Sloan opened the door and pulled her inside.
This is insane.
The weight of the situation was beginning to dawn on her. Baby Charlotte Margolis had dominated the news and tabloids for nearly a year after she and her parents disappeared, and even this many decades later, the American public was obsessed with her story. And now they were desperate for the sequel, the return of baby Charlotte Margolis.
You're like a famous movie star dodging the paparazzi.
Nora looked down and saw Sloan's bag.
Good, you're packed.
Nora grabbed Sloan's suitcase.
Follow me.
Where are we going?
We're getting the hell out of here.
They'll just follow us.
Unlikely. Just trust me. Ready?
Sloane nodded. Nora opened the front door and ran down the steps with Sloane's suitcase in tow and Sloane close behind. Sloane ignored the questions as she raced to Nora's car, ripped open the passenger side door, and quickly climbed in. Nora threw the suitcase into the back seat, sat behind the wheel, and slammed her door closed. The engine was still running, and she dropped the car into reverse and backed into the street, scattering the cameramen who had encroached on the vehicle. When she was clear, she put the car into drive and sped off. It took just a moment for the news crews to throw their equipment into the backs of the vans and start their pursuit. But by then, it was too late. As the vans spun around the cul-de-sac, a Ford F-150 skidded to a stop at the end of the street, blocking the crews from exiting the neighborhood.
Get the hell out of the way!
The window of the F-150 rolled down to reveal Lester Strange, the Margolis family's longtime handyman.
No can do.
Nora pulled down the alley behind her studio and parked next to the dumpster.
Who was that in the pickup truck?
Lester, our handyman. He's as loyal as they come. I asked him for a favor and he didn't hesitate. It bought us some time. Come on.
Inside, Nora closed the blinds.
You're safe here for now, but the rest of this town is a crapshoot. Reporters believe you're staying at the Cedar Creek Inn and there are a bunch of news crews there. Now, they obviously found your rental house. Reporters are looking outside the gates of Tilly and Reed's estate, too. They'll probably go to my house at some point, but my studio is too far removed for anyone to find us here. For a while, at least. We're working on Plan B.
Maybe I should just talk to them.
No way. You need a lawyer before you do that. You could get a nice payday out of it if you give the right person an exclusive. Probably pay off all your medical school debt. Plus, I'd talk with that FBI agent you mentioned before you start dishing out interviews. Never know what you can and can't say.
Sloane walked over to the window and peeked through the blinds.
So we're just gonna hide at your studio? For how long?
Hopefully not long. Tilly said things should be ready in about an hour.
What things?
Until we can help you organize the right journalist to speak with in the right setting, we're getting you out of Cedar Creek.
And going where?
Margolis Manor. The family's winery is the only logical choice. It's only a few hours away, but it may as well be on the other side of the earth, because once we're there, no one will find us or bother us. Even if the press somehow tracked us there, the property is massive and impossible for anyone to penetrate. We can stay there until things settle down, or at least until we figure out your best path forward.
Are you sure? I feel terrible that I've brought all this drama with me.
Of course. It was Reed's idea. A couple thousand acres of isolated land covered by wine grapes in Oregon? It's perfect. Reed's arranging things now, and we'll call when everything's set. The press outside the front gates of Reed and Tilly's estate are throwing a wrench into things at the moment, but he's figuring that out as we speak. For now, we'll just wait here until we get the all clear.
Sloane rubbed the front of her pants. A buzzing nervousness filled her gut. She needed to find a discreet way to call Eric and let him know what was happening.
Oh, look at you. You're a nervous wreck.
I just feel awful for putting everyone in such an awkward position.
Listen, there are lots of things about Ellis's family that are hard to swallow. But one thing Tilly and Reed are good at is protecting the people they care about. They'll help you navigate this thing with the media. They have the contacts and the influence to calm this frenzy down and get you in touch with the right people. It'll just take some time.
Nora pointed at the remaining boxes of Annabelle's photos.
Let's finish looking through the last two boxes. It'll get your mind off all this nonsense.
Through the congestion in Sloane's mind and the anxiety coursing through her veins, a thought came to her. She and Eric had spent the previous night combing through the details of the investigation into the disappearance of her and her birth parents. The biggest revelation they'd come across was that Annabelle's blood had been found in the kitchen of her home, having been cleaned up in an attempt to hide the evidence. The closets in the home were empty, and Preston and Annabelle's clothes were missing, hinting that they'd left of their own volition. Margot Gray's confession that someone had paid her to pose as baby Charlotte's birth mother only added to the confusion. When midnight came, Sloane and Eric had more questions than answers. But perhaps the boxes in front of her and the photos Annabelle took that summer held the missing pieces of the puzzle.
Are Annabelle's photos time-stamped?
They should be.
Nora walked over to one of the boxes and removed a photo. In the bottom right corner, the date was stamped in red. Nora held the photo up.
Yes, June 22nd, 1995.
Sloane squinted and lifted her chin.
How close do the photos come to July 4th?
Nora looked at the remaining boxes and then back at Sloane, a shade of understanding coloring her eyes.
The day she disappeared?
Yeah. You've seen most of these photos. How close do they come to July 4th?
All the way to that morning, if I remember correctly.
Let's see.
Sloane and Nora took turns checking the street for news crews. They made it through the second box of photos and found, toward the bottom, an envelope of pictures dated July 4th, 1995, the day Annabelle Margolis disappeared with her husband and two-month-old daughter. The day, Sloane knew from the case file, that a large amount of Annabelle's blood had been cleaned up from the kitchen floor.
Here, these are from July 4th.
Nora quickly paged through the photos.
Yeah, I remember developing these. I didn't do it myself. I brought the film to the drugstore to be developed. The rolls of film were among Annabelle and Preston's belongings when we eventually cleared out the house weeks after they... and you went missing.
She handed the photos to Sloane.
Who's looked at these?
I have, but years and years ago. And the detectives investigating the case wanted to see them, but they never found anything interesting. They gave them back to me, and they've been sitting in my attic ever since. Until Ellis pulled them out for me the other day.
Sloane and Nora removed the pictures, dozens of glossy 4x6s, and spread them across the table. Sloane's fingers tingled with anticipation as she arranged the photos. They revealed the story of her and her birth parents' last day in Cedar Creek, told through the lens of Annabelle's camera. The images began in the morning, with beautiful shots of the sunrise off the back deck of Preston and Annabelle's new home. Then the photos proceeded to the Split the Creek Gala in town, where the 4th of July celebration had taken place.
Here's you in your stroller.
Nora passed Sloane a photo of baby Charlotte tucked into a stroller and protected from the sun by the overhanging visor.
You were so dang cute.
There were several photos of baby Charlotte alone, and a few with her in Preston's arms.
All of these were taken on the Nikon FM-10 I gifted Annabelle that summer. She carried that camera everywhere, kept it hanging around her neck and shot anything that looked photogenic.
Nora removed the last photo from the envelope.
God, she was good. Look how she framed this photo of you.
Nora held up a photo of baby Charlotte lying on a red, white, and blue blanket positioned on the lawn next to the creek, blurred images of sailboats drifting past in the background. Sloane took the photo and examined it. The date was stamped in red at the bottom of the photo.
The Split the Creek Gala for the 4th. Is that still a thing around here?
Oh, sure. It's been going on as long as I can remember. This past July was the biggest turnout in Cedar Creek history.
So it's an all-day thing?
Yes, starts in the morning and runs straight through until sunset. A huge fireworks show wraps things up at night.
Sloane held up the photo of herself on the blanket.
So this is sometime in the late morning or early afternoon, based on the sunlight. And this is the last photo in the bunch. Are there more from that day? It's the day we all disappeared. It's worth looking at what Annabelle's last photos were. Unless this is it, and then it doesn't tell us much.
These photos were from the last roll of film we found. We didn't find any other rolls in the house.
What's in the last box?
Sloane pointed at the lone remaining cardboard box at the end of the table.
Just random photography equipment that was left at Preston and Annabelle's house. No one knew what to do with the stuff when we were emptying out the house, so I took it.
Nora stood up and walked to the far side of the table. She lifted the last box and carried it over to Sloane. When Nora removed the top, she paused, her forehead burrowed with wrinkles.
What the hell?
What's wrong? More pictures?
No, just this.
Nora reached into the box and, from the random bits of equipment, removed a camera.
It's Annabelle's. The Nikon FM-10 I gave her that summer.
Why is that strange?
Because this wasn't with Annabelle's belongings when we cleared out the house.
Are you sure? It was nearly 30 years ago.
I'm sure. I gave it to her as a birthday present, and I wondered where it went. Part of me figured that if Annabelle had gone on the run, she'd have taken it with her.
We both know Annabelle didn't go on the run.
Nora nodded.
Then how did her camera end up in the box if she didn't leave it at her house?
Nora looked at Sloane and then back to the camera, turning it over as if holding an ancient relic.
I don't know.
Nora twisted the camera one last time and then pulled it close to examine it.
Son of a gun, there's still a roll of film in here.
In the camera?
Yes.
Sloane stood.
Are there photos on it?
It shows 3 shots remain. That means there are 21 undeveloped photos in here.
A continuation of what's here.
Sloane pointed to the photos that covered the table.
From the day we all disappeared, right? They have to be from the same day.
Nora's lips remained separated, slack-jawed by what they'd discovered.
Let's find out.
Sloane's stomach roiled with anxiety and a foreboding sense that the mystery of her life was about to be uncovered.
What's wrong?
Sloane shook her head.
Nothing. I'm just nervous, I guess, to see what's on the photos.
We don't have to look at these.
Of course we do. Can we develop them in the darkroom?
Yes, but only if you're sure.
Let's go.
Nora?
Ellis walked into the studio.
We're ready, but we've got to leave now. The news crews are still outside the house, but my parents are leaving through the maintenance road behind the property.
I had Sloane pack her things.
Nora pointed to Sloane's suitcase.
Perfect. I'll put this in the car.
Ellis wheeled Sloane's suitcase to the back door.
What about Annabelle's photos?
Nora took the camera and stuffed it into her bag.
I've got a dark room at the house up north. We'll develop them there.
At the winery?
Yes, from back in the day.
Ready?
Are we all driving together?
Not driving. Flying. My father chartered a helicopter to get us the hell out of here.